Sunday with Miriam on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Travel Department. Explore the wonder of the world's most iconic sites with Travel Department, the world discovered together.
But look, first this morning, award-winning author Colin McCann is home from the US because tonight in Dublin's Unitarian Church, he'll join forces again with his good friend, fiddle player, agus léachan ceoil Colm McAnamara, to raise funds for an organisation called Narrative 4, which he co-founded. Colin McCann, good morning. Welcome to our studio and welcome home. How are you?
It's such a pleasure. So nice always to be back.
Yeah, it's great. And you're looking really healthy, which is always a good sign.
Relatively healthy.
Listen, tell me a bit first about this gig and about your collaboration with the great Colm McAnamara. It goes back a while, doesn't it?
Oh, Colm and I have travelled. We've travelled to the West Bank. We've gone to South Africa. We've gone all over Ireland. We've been to the cultural centre in Paris. I don't think there's a better musician in the world, but there's also not a better soul to hang around with. And we sort of dovetail together. I read, he plays, he improvises, and somehow he consults with the angels, and he produces this sound which I just think is fantastic. It's halfway between Philip Glass and Planxty, and yet it's entirely his own.
Unbelievable. All those McAnamaras. I don't know what was in the water, but they're all so talented. Now, this organisation, Narrative 4, tell me about it. Where did it start and what was the impetus behind it?
Well, it's a fantastic organisation which really has its roots in Ireland. Yes, we started in Chicago, actually. Sting, who helped launch it, the musician, he's been with us now for 12 years. It's an international global organisation. We're in 30 plus countries at this stage, 12 in Africa. We're all over the schools in Ireland. A shout out to every school in Ireland that's running the Narrative 4 programme. It's really quite incredible. What happens is that young people get together and they tell each other a story, and then they tell that same story back to one another in the first person. It's all about a sort of leap of radical empathy. So you tell my story, I tell yours, and suddenly the distance between us is shortened, because the shortest distance between any two people is always going to be a story. How do we get to know each other? But not something that tries to go win an argument, whether it be about politics or the internet or anything like that. There's nothing didactic about it. We tell each other a personal story, and then suddenly we realise that all that distance collapses, and it's really quite fantastic.
And when you were thinking of expanding this to other places, I mean, what kind of focus did you have in mind for those young people you're talking about, especially here in Ireland? I mean, where do you think empathy is needed the most here?
Well, I think it's needed in every single interaction. You know, whether we go down to the supermarket, whether we're talking to the taxi driver, whether it's the person who just opened the door for you, or whether it's the person you want to open the door for. I mean, it is the oil into which all this human connection goes. We need to understand one another, and that goes across, across the street, but also across these continents, which is kind of what's wonderful about what we do. We can link young people in Chicago with young people from Limerick, young people in Belfast with young people from the West Bank. This is the sort of thing that we're doing, and they realize that after a certain time, well, I'm not so lonely anymore, because they've had this crisis of loneliness and isolation, particularly in the past 5 years. I wouldn't want to be 15, 20 years old at this particular juncture. It's very, very, very difficult. But we do find that when they get together, somehow they sort of light up in all sorts of new ways. And the most important thing is we want them to use those stories to create social change. So, for example, in the South Bronx, the kids realised that a lot of their stories were about gunshot victims. So they started a group for helping with gunshot victims. In Kentucky, there was a lot about opioids. In Limerick, there was a lot of talk about difficulty with suicide and so on. So groups get together, young people get together, they identify, say, a social problem. And from that social problem, then they are the ones who come up with an answer.
And isn't it interesting, though, Colm, that you felt, and other people have felt, and obviously it's very successful, that we needed it. I mean, was there a time, you know, when young people just spoke to each other? Why do we need it?
Maybe I'm nostalgic about it, but I do think there was a time when it was a lot easier to talk to one another. Now we feel that we have access to one another, so we're all connected, but we're completely disconnected at the same time. So we hold in our hands this, you know, this machine, which is plastic and silicon and whatever else. And we believe we're actually talking to the human being at the far end. And in certain ways we are, because technology is good. But also there is a disconnect there, that when these, say, young people get together, and certainly like in a classroom together, or if we bring them together for a global conference, the sparks and the relationships and the differences, like young people who, you know, say came from working class New Orleans, they meet these kids from Haiti. This is one of the programs that, that we have done in the past. And so they didn't even realize that Haiti is a different country. And then like they begin to study all these things. We've had kids, believe this or not, in Eastern Kentucky, from the Hollers. Now, these are young people who have very, very, very little. Suddenly talking with young people who are in the West Bank, Nablus in the West Bank. And they're completely stunned by everything that's going on, but they learn and they ask questions and they start to change things within their communities. Maybe not enough. But.
And is that how you measure it? Is that how you know that this works?
I know it works. Because school test scores go up, absentee levels go down, engagement goes up. Teachers are the heroes. I have to say this. I think it's really, really, really important. I wish we would pay them more. I wish we'd look after their whole lives, their whole... because talk about people who are on the front line. I go to American airports and they say, anybody in military uniform, you know, or on active military duty, please come up and get on the plane first. And I'm grand with that. I'm not gonna argue against it. But the ones who are absolutely really on the front line, and every teacher out there this morning, they know exactly what I'm talking about, because you go into that classroom every day and it's a new set of problems that you have to confront. They, to me, they're the heroes. So they link with us at Narrative 4, and then they bring the kids in and they begin to change things from the ground up.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and teachers. And do you think, Colm, is there any positive in the way that young people interact on social media? Or do you think you have to get them offline for this to work?
That's a good question. I mean, for the actual moment when we're bringing them together, I don't want them like looking at their telephones. But there's plenty of good things in terms of communication, in terms of involving people with one another. We actually use the internet. So we're not going to be able to bring a young person from, say, Nigeria, from Lagos, together with someone from Dublin, unless we're able to use the internet. But in a safe, powerful, positive way. So there's always two ends. There's always a good argument at the end of a bad argument. Technology is good, technology is bad. And holding these different balances. I think the times are out of kilter. I don't know how you feel about it. The times are out of balance because we only want to hold one end of the argument. And then things get completely out of balance. We're so certain about ourselves that it's almost, I talk about it as being the disease of certainty. And if we're not certain, I like messiness. I like kids who ask questions. I like kids who say, oh, maybe that's not true. And they're the ones who are going to change things.
That's so interesting. So it's the idea that people can hold several things to be true at the same time, isn't
it? Yeah. Well, you think even about all the peace processes that are going on. You think about our own peace process. You think about Senator Mitchell, 27, almost 28 years ago. Can you believe it's been that long? So we brought these young people in the Living Legends Project recently from South Hill in Limerick together with Shankill. It sounds great, doesn't it? South Hill and Shankill. But, you know, they wouldn't have known each other. They would have been scared of each other walking into the room. And then suddenly, these ideas that they have about each other get destroyed because they actually like one another. And they say, oh, you don't have four heads. Oh, you're not, you know, going to say something bad about me because I come from a certain area of town. And so these contradictions then come together and you mash them together. And it's almost messy in a good way. I want to write an essay, I think. Now, but you'd have to see my office now to know why I want to write this essay. It's called In Praise of Messiness.
So you can put a photo above your messy office.
Oh, I have an extremely messy office. I'll definitely put a photo up. I'll send one to you.
So in other ways, I suppose, grey areas you think are okay in life, or a space in which you can change your mind, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like that area where you walk in and you don't actually know. Mm. Look, the other thing is, I'm like you. I like people. I like places. I like to go in somewhere and discover new things, but not everybody does. Mm. Some people are tentative and they go there and they're not sure and they don't want to enter that grey area. But if you give them some little access to the grey area, say, like, take this little grey path, just go down here and you'll begin to change things. Then suddenly, and I think we can do it in our schools, I actually think it's very important to do so on a large level, not just in a school, not just in a community, but maybe even on a national level, to start to talk about holding these different things that seemingly are disparate to one another. And then we begin to like each other more when we actually just tell each other that little personal story. So even someone from the far right with somebody from the far left, and you think between them is absolutely nothing but a huge ditch that they're both going to collapse into. Suddenly, you know, if you give them a chance, because we're all human, and that sounds a little bit twee sometimes, but the fact of the matter is, we're all human. Mm. And we begin to recognise that in certain ways and bring one another together. I think, you know, some people say it's sentimental. Mm. It's naive. But look, it's Christmas time. I'm going to be sentimental and naive. No. I think we can bring one another together.
Great. Listen, one of our texters, and I don't know if you're going to be able to convince this person, but John just sent a text to say, Miriam, empathy is destroying the West. I mean, how calm do you respond, which is perfectly legitimate, it's his thought, but to that kind of thinking?
Well, I'm empathetic with that kind of thinking. I mean, the thing is that we have to look at, so really what John is probably saying is that, you know, in trying to understand one another, we're allowing, you know, things to come into our minds, things to come into our lives, things come into our societies that we don't necessarily want. Now, I don't agree with him, but I would like to sit down and have a talk with him, and I bet that he could change some of my mind, and I'm bet that I could change some of his mind. And that's really what it's all about.
He should go to the Unitarian Church this evening.
Please come along to the Unitarian. We still have tickets left, by the way, which is kind of fantastic. I can't believe it, because we're going to have, well, Colm McInerney, obviously, as we said earlier, but a whole host of musicians and an auction and a bit of crack, as I say.
So what time is it kicking off?
7 o'clock. Doors open 7 o'clock.
And I'll mention it again before the end of our interview. Now, you, I think, had an audience with Pope Leo this year.
How did you know that?
What struck you about him and his impressions? Were you impressed?
I was impressed. Mm. Yeah. And it was in August. And I went there with Diane Foley, who's a woman who I wrote about, whose son had been murdered by ISIS in 2014. And Pope Leo wanted to talk to her, and I'd written about her. And we went into a room. And at one stage, he actually popped his head around the door to check that we were still in the room, because he was talking with somebody else in another room, because he really wanted to talk to her. And talking about empathy, well, let's talk about listening and compassion, because if the word empathy doesn't work, let's talk about some other word. It was fascinating to watch him listen to the stories that were being told. Now, is he the same as Francis? I also got to meet Francis the year beforehand, which was also an incredible thing. No, he's not the same person, and he's learning, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, learning that goes on. But I have to say that I thought you could see that he was somebody who wanted to do things. And maybe he's a bit tentative, even now, at first. You know, you see him, he's off in Turkey and he's off in the Middle East talking. I think some of the messages will get louder as time goes along.
Do you have faith? I mean, obviously, let's shout out to your mum, Sally, who's currently, we won't give her age, no, but she's alive and well in Dean's Grange
in
Dublin.
She's amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
Amazing
I'm
woman.
I'm so happy that she's listening to the show and still going strong. Do I have faith? Yeah, I have faith in human beings. I don't know what else I have faith in. Mm. I have faith in stories, storytelling. Mm. I have faith in the fact that we can connect with one another. Mm. I have faith in the fact that we can be nice to one another, even though a lot of the time that we're not. And so I've written about Israel and Palestine a lot recently. Mm. And my two favorite people, Rami and Bassam, recently came to Ireland and we did a big tour together. But their point is this. Look, we don't have to love one another. Mm. We don't even have to like one another, though we hope that eventually we could. But we absolutely must understand one another. Because if we don't understand one another, we'll be talking to each other from 6 feet underground and trying to understand one another's stories. So I have faith in that notion, which is supposedly simple notion, but nothing is really simple, especially simplicity. So so for Rami and Bassam and for others in that sort of situation, whom I learn from, my faith goes out to them.
And you would want to be very optimistic, Colm. You were talking there about Palestine, to see how empty is ever going to solve the conflict between Israel and Palestine. I mean, there's supposed to be a truce. The strikes continue. Are you optimistic?
I think you have to be in the end. I think peace is an inevitability. Rami and Bassam, in particular, the Palestinian, will say to you, who could have believed that, you know, 20 years after the Holocaust, there would be a Israeli embassy in Bonn and a German embassy in Tel Aviv? Who could have believed that, that things would change? Who could have believed that things would have changed in Northern Ireland? Who could have believed that the Berlin Wall could come down? We can't foresee these things. The real task is to hope for it, to believe that you can put a little chink of light, like Leonard Cohen, we used to say, put a chink of the light in the wall. That's how the light gets through. So I am a what Gramsci would say, a pessimist of the intellect. In other words, I know the world is dark, and an optimist of the will. In other words, that I want things to be better. You can hold both those things at the exact same time and not be naive about what's going on. So you have to fight against it and also believe that you can change some things, which is what a lot of the young people, say, in Narrative 4 are doing. Getting out, changing things in their community.
And I noticed as well that the Irish Embassy in Israel mentioned the play of, obviously, that fab book, A Paragon. It's so long reaching that. I think it's showing at the Jaffa Theatre in Tel Aviv, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. There's all sorts of iterations going on. There's iterations in the West Bank of people who are doing things about Rami and Bassam. There are things going on in Israel, especially in the Palestinian community in Israel. They've sort of embraced that book and the message of Rami and Bassam. And so for me to be a part of it, I feel... Look, I'm Irish. I live in New York, and then I've written about Israel and Palestine. But I feel like a ventriloquist. And the ventriloquism is because I want to talk about peace. And I feel lucky enough to be in this situation and to just give the words of people like those two men who lost their daughters, paid the highest price, to give their stories a chance.
And I know Twist, your most recent novel about undersea cables and the nature of connected communication, has gone down really well. How is your writing going? I mean, do you have a plan when you write? Do you get up and write every morning? Or do you get bursts when you're writing a novel?
My perfect day would be waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and going straight to work, and then you know, writing for 3, 4, 5 hours before I got up and walked the dog and did all sorts of things and did all the normal things of the day. I never get a perfect day. So it's in bursts, it's in bits and pieces, it's on planes, it's here, there and everywhere. But listen, the world is full of stories. I've got too many stories running around my head right now. I'm trying to focus in on one, anyone in particular.
Yeah, but do you find it a gift that that is what you have successfully made as your living? Like, I was lucky enough to meet you with your dad, Sean, that wonderful writer who gave so many people an opportunity to write. But is it lovely that you make your great living as a writer?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's shocking to me. I mean, honestly, when I think back on myself, you know, being here in Dublin at the age of 17 and going into the newspapers and thinking, yeah, I want to do journalism, but eventually I want to write a book of some sort. it's hard for me to wake up and believe, here I am, 60 yeah. years old, and I'm doing this stuff.
Yeah,
it's kind
so
of wonderful.
Well.
Well, thank you. But no. but I feel indebted to so many different people. And my father, Sean, being one of the fulcrum ones.
Beautiful man.
Yeah, he was a fantastic man. He's gone like almost 12 years now. So, but he's still here. That's the thing, right?
Okay.
In our stories,
yeah,
we exist. They can take away a lot of things. They can take away your house. They can take away a car. They can take away your life. But they can never, ever, ever eventually take away your story. And I love that notion that we hang around, and particularly if we've done good stuff, we hang around for a long, long time.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way of looking at it.
That's faith.
I think.
There you go.
Yeah, that is faith. Listen, Lauren Limerick says, Colm still has his Dublin accent after decades in the US. He's an Irish man we should be so proud of. I was in Limerick for a Paragon, his book about Rami and Bassam. Please tell him how much our family adored that event. And another says, my son's teachers deliver the Narrative 4 programme for first years, a great way to build friendships and bonds. He was so shy and it helped him find his group. I'm grateful for it and to hear about it this morning. And you're going, yes, isn't that great?
Can I tell you a beautiful thing happened? I was in Mayo at the Rolling Sun Festival, and three groups of school kids came along to listen to Rami and Bassam, and then there was a rustling in the audience towards the end, and people, you know, I was saying, that's not very good. Why are all these kids rustling around? At the very end of it, they came up with a plastic folder full of coins, of money to give to kids in Gaza and in the West Bank, and it almost broke my heart. It was one of the most beautiful things I have seen in ages. So there are people out there and they're doing these things, and they're also listening to these stories. So I have also, again, faith is our theme today, faith in the fact that a lot of these young people are going to come along and they'll show us exactly what it is that we can do. But that was one of the best moments, in a hotel in Westport and all these young people searching in their pockets for 20 cents, 50 cents, 5 euros, 10 euros from different people, and thought, okay, that's good stuff.
God, break your heart. It's so beautiful, actually. Well, look, Colm, every time I speak to you, I love talking to you. You're incredibly uplifting and meaningful in life. Now, you and Colm McInamara and your guests, lots of them, are hosting tonight a Christmas benefit night in aid of Narrative 4, and it's in the Unitarian Church here in Dublin at 7:30. It's nearly sold out, but there are still tickets available on narrative4.ie and Eventbrite. Colm McCann, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you so much.
Love to Sally.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break.